I'd like to introduce our guest, Professor Moshe Amarov, who is here visiting us from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in Israel. It's his first time in Canada, and he's going to see the Rockies. But today he's going to speak to us about the role of Jerusalem, so two cities in conflict. He served as an advisor to Prime Minister Ehud Barak during the Camp David negotiations. And he's been involved in a number of negotiations with conflicts in other areas in the world, such as Belfast. So he has a wide-ranging experience, which is not only theoretical from his work as a professor at the Hebrew University, but also practical from actually being involved in some very complex and difficult situations and negotiations. So we're very pleased to have him with us, and I'd like to give you to give him a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you again. I am a visitor here. Actually, I came to visit my brother, who is here on a position 2 years. And he said, look, you have to see the Rockies. You can't say Rockies. I mean, I've been all over the world. What's this Rockies? He said, come and see. So I came and saw. And now I'm convinced that it is really special. And I mean, since I'm here, he says that maybe you'll give two lectures to the university there and maybe here. I said, I'm really on vacation now. He said, you have to. So I'm actually doing it with a lot of happiness, because I share with you something that we are all part of, which is Jerusalem, the city, my city, the city I live, and the city I was attached to so many years. It's a city in which I teach at Mount Scopus. I don't know who of you, if you have been in Israel, in Jerusalem. On Mount Scopus, we have the Hebrew University, one of a very good university, 50,000 students. I teach political science. And Jerusalem is one of the issues that has to do with my subject. But I came here not as a professor, to tell you the truth, and I'm not going to give you an academic lecture. It will be a little bit boring. I just came to tell you a story. I'll tell you my story. And my story is the story of Jerusalem, and I will share it with you because I am very much involved in the life of this city, all the aspects. I mean, the religious one, the academic one. I have my house in Jerusalem, my family. I have children. The first one was called on the name of Jerusalem, Iri. I fought in this city as a soldier, a paratrooper, a young paratrooper in 1967. And in this war, I always start with this story because it's very personal, and I'll carry it with me all the time, the memories of this war. And you know, we Israelis, we fought a few wars. I fought 3 wars in my life. So this was the first one in Jerusalem. And it was the most important one because we were, as young paratroopers, very exciting to liberate Jerusalem. Now, the liberation of Jerusalem, or to deliberate Jerusalem, is not a new thing. I mean, I counted about 40 conquerors who liberated Jerusalem. I was the last one. And when I was in this battle, I was wounded near the old city, and taken to the hospital because I got a shrapnel in my head, a Jordanian shrapnel. And the doctor said to me, okay, relax, we are going tomorrow to have the operation, we'll take the shrapnel out. I see it on the rentgen, and I was sitting in my room, laying in my bed with bandage. And I was listening to the radio, and in the radio they said, okay, the paratroopers coming now to the Wailing Wall. And in a few minutes they will touch the Wailing Wall. And this was a historic moment for many, many Israelis and Jews all over the world. And I say to myself, come on, Moshe, you are laying here in bed, and they are doing history, your friends there. So I say to the doctor, look, can I just go for a few hours? I'll come back. But I have something to arrange there in Jerusalem, in the old city. I said, are you crazy? You have a shrapnel in your head. You can't move. Stay here. Went out of the room. I left the room. I ran out. I hitchhiked to the old city. It's not far. That's a hospital from the place. And I went in. I met my friends. They gave me a helmet because they were still shooting there. And I ran. I had a camera. I ran to the Wailing Wall. I was standing there. I took a picture for the history of myself near the wall. And I wrote on a piece of paper my wish. You know, we Jews, we put this. And on this paper, I wrote one word, peace. And I put it there, hoping that the Lord will listen to this wish. And we don't have peace in Jerusalem yet, after 40 years. When they took out the shrapnel, the doctor gave it to me and said, keep it. And remember, you were 1 centimeter far away from death. So I keep it. It's here, right here, on my ring, reminding me how close I was to death and how excited I was when I put this peace request from the Lord. So actually, I'm going to speak about something which is very personal. It's my city. But it's not only my city. It's the city of the world. And Jerusalem, for that matter, is very special and unique. I'll speak a little bit about the uniqueness of this city from the political aspect and also from the religious aspect. These are the two main issues I'm going to speak with you or tell you. And I'll do it not in an academic way, as I say, but as a story. And I've been involved in this city, and I have so many stories. Some of them I put in some books, academic books and others. And the most famous book is called Jerusalem Syndrome. You can get it through Amazon and read it if you want. It's in English. And in this book, I tell the story of Camp David 2 in the year 2000, where I was serving as assistant to the Prime Minister Barak. Actually, I was preparing the whole portfolio of Jerusalem for arrangement between us and the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat was there. And Bill Clinton, the President of America, was trying, really trying, for 10 days to bring us, Palestinians and Israelis, together and find a solution for the situation between us in the Middle East. In the end of these 10 days that we were there, we couldn't find a solution. We went home and the Second Intifada started. The Second Intifada began when the next prime minister, 1 year later, Ariel Sharon, went up to Temple Mount. And it raised so much turmoil in the Palestinian camp, especially after the failure to get peace in Camp David. And that's how the Second Intifada started. But when we were there in Camp David, the hopes were very high. And for me, you know, I'm a professor dealing with cities in conflict. And I've been in all of them. I mean, I've been to Belfast, I've been to Nicosia. In some places I was even involved in the negotiation between the parties, bringing my experience in negotiation over the cities. But I can tell you one thing, which is important to understand. Jerusalem is not like any of these cities I've seen, I've been. And I've been in all these troubled cities in the world. It's different. And many times, people like Teddy Kollek, the mayor, asked me, why is it so difficult here? And I said, you know, I'm a professor for political science. We have what we call ectos in the game or in the set of relationship. And in this set, we have one actor, I say to Teddy Kollek, and later on, years later, to Ehud Barak. His name is God. He's the main player in this city. And when he is involved, things are getting a little bit difficult. They're getting difficult because when you deal with somebody who has the faith, Christian, Muslim for that matter, or Jew, he is on a mission. God sent him. And he knows that he is speaking now and he is fighting now to find a solution to the city of God. And that makes things very, very complicated, let me tell you. So I had a long career in the city municipality. I worked with Teddy Kollek on the infrastructure. I built the roads there. And just to give you one example of the complexity, one road I built, it's called Road Number 1. It's really in the center of Jerusalem, and it goes between the old city and the new city. And when I started to build this road, immediately we have riots in the city. Now, it was not Palestinians against Israelis. It was Israelis who are super religious, also Orthodox, you know, those who are not Zionists, dressed in black. They are a third of the population in Jerusalem, one third. And their rabbis took them all out in thousands. They had demonstrations. They didn't let my tractors to start walking on the road. So we had it one day, and then a second day, and then a third day, and they didn't get tired. They came every day demonstrating with stones, violence. So Teddy Kollek, the mayor, called me, and he said, Moshe, what's happening here? Why are they so violent? I mean, we need this road. This is the only way to put the road. It was right on the border. You know, the border, nobody built there until 1967. So it was an open lane that I could put the road to for Jerusalem. And I said, you see, Teddy, it's a matter of religion. It's not that they live there or it disturbs them. It doesn't disturb them at all. So who is it that it disturbs this road that you are building? I say, they say, and maybe they're right, that this is a cemetery there on. And there are the dead people there, the bodies and the remains of dead people. And we cannot build this road here. Because the road, the minute you build it, according to the Jewish halacha, Jewish religion, you have to have air for the soul. I'm not going into it. I'm not an expert on it, but I understand that if there is a cemetery there, you can build on it the road. And I was talking with these rabbis, and I said, look, we don't have any other choice but here. This is the only lane we can put the road. They said, no way, you will not have a road here, Professor Amirav. So I was thinking, what can I do? And the idea I came with was that I will speak with these leaders. I took with me the deputy mayor, who was a religious rabbi. We went together, and I came with the idea and asked them, is it possible for me to build the road on a kind of a bridge? So we will have 20 centimeters of air. So the souls will not suffer. You know what? They said, that's a great idea, Professor Amirav. If you do it, the bridge, no demonstrations. Go ahead. Okay, a bridge like this is $200,000-$300,000. I came to the boss, to the colleague. I said, look, I need another $300,000. I solved the problem. So what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to build a bridge of 1 kilometer, and it will be on the top of this. And the religious, they agreed to it? I said, yes. Okay, here you have $300,000. Go and build the bridge. I built the bridge. One day, they came from the New York Times to interview me. I showed them the road. They laughed. They made the article a full page in the New York Times. How the dead people in Jerusalem are much more important than those who live in it, in this city. They love it. I'm telling you this funny story that is a kind of illustration to who is more important in Jerusalem. So first it's God, and then it's the dead. And then the citizens. I mean, we are temporary anyway. I mean, Palestinians, Israelis, whatever. So you understand that the minute we have God involved, it's getting a little bit more complicated. And through the years, and the negotiation was, for many years I was involved in the negotiation with the Palestinians trying to bring peace to my country. And through these negotiations, I got to know, of course, the leaders of the Palestinians, not only Arafat. I went to him to Tunis. We had a lot of talks. But a friend, a very close friend of mine, Faisal Husseini, he's from the Husseini family, one of the most notable families, and we got to be not only friends, like brothers, comrades in war. I say to him, we are together. And we started in this kind of a dialogue, writing papers about a solution to Jerusalem. We knew that when we will sit to the table, seriously trying to find the solution to all the issues between us and the Palestinians, Jerusalem will be number one. And this is what happened. Later on, years later, we were serving both of us in Camp David. He was the advisor on Jerusalem to Arafat. I was the advisor on Jerusalem to Barak, my prime minister. So we sit together, me and my friend, for years. We had all the papers. We had all the plan. We knew what we want. We even agreed. Now, it's a big... The small problem was to try and convince Mr. Arafat and Mr. Barak to agree to our plan. And this was not easy. Actually, we failed. What is it that we agreed on through the years of conversation, of speaking about it in Jerusalem? Our idea was that without giving up some of the, I would say, the prerequisite demands of Palestinians and Israelis, we will not be able to find a solution. And two, that we need a special arrangement in the Old City, which is 1 square kilometer out of the 130 square kilometers of the city. And in this 1 kilometer, we have a very little place, which is called Temple Mount. And on Temple Mount, there is one mosque, Haram al-Sharif. And to find a solution to Jerusalem, we came to the conclusion that we have to divide the city, but we have to leave it open. No border, no wall. And we have to make out of Jerusalem two cities, actually, two capitals. The capital of Palestine, Al-Quds, in Arabic, the Holy, and Jerusalem, Yerushalayim in Hebrew, for the Israel. It will be recognized as the capital of these two countries. Now, just to you who are not so much aware of the status of Jerusalem, Jerusalem in 1948 was the main battlefield between Israel and the neighbors, especially the Jordanian Legion army of King Abdullah. But before the war, there was a decision of the United Nations about the future of the land of Israel and Jerusalem. And they said, the land of Israel will be separated, two countries, Arab country, Jewish country. Jerusalem will be international. This was the resolution, 181. It's a famous resolution. But what happened actually in 48 is that the Arab Legion went into Jerusalem, took over the eastern side, the old city. So Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, went with the Israeli army and took the western side. So until 1967, it was a divided city. This is history. Now, 67, we, Israelis, we united the city. We made out of it one city. We didn't succeed in our national goals in Jerusalem. I mean, we had in mind a kind of a future for this city. First of all, we were sure that after the big victory in 1967, we will have peace in no time, a week, 2 weeks. We'll have peace. We didn't have peace. Since 1967 until today, we have peace only with two Arab countries, Jordan, Egypt, but not with the Palestinians, not with Syria. Actually, not with the Arab world. If you want, not with the Muslim world. And Jerusalem is at the heart of the problem. Whenever I go abroad and I meet with prime ministers, professors in the academia, they all raise the question of Jerusalem. So here we are sitting in Camp David 2000, and I bring all my papers to my boss, the prime minister, and I say, look, these are the options. And I also want to tell you that the option I prefer is the option that we prepared, me and Faisal Husseini. And he looks at it, and he said, okay, let's see if Arafat agrees to your paper. And this was the negotiation. 4 days out of the 10 days that we were in Camp David, 4 days we dealt with Jerusalem. The other days we dealt with other issues that were security, settlements, refugees. Some of you know. But Jerusalem took 4 days. And I must say something about the people who were with me, and I was very much impressed, of course, sitting together 10 days with the President of the United States. And he was really dedicated to find the solution to Jerusalem. He said to me, I'm a religious man. For me, Jerusalem is important. It's in my blood. I said, okay. So, please help us. And we were sitting there in groups and together and separately, and we couldn't find the solution to Jerusalem. All the other issues, we were very close, almost finished. In Jerusalem, it was a problem. Although Israel, or Barak for that matter, went quite a long way. He was ready to divide Jerusalem. Now, the division of Jerusalem in the Israeli terminology, you have to understand, is something new. For years, decades, we Israelis were not even ready to think about the division of Jerusalem. When I spoke about the division of Jerusalem, we have to divide Jerusalem 25 years ago, it was, I would say, 5% of the Israeli public will support my idea to divide the city. In the years, this percentage went up. Today, most Israelis, 60%, are ready to divide Jerusalem. So it is a shift in the thinking of Israelis, but also Palestinians. So let's come back to Camp David. In Camp David, we agreed on most of the issues. Even in Jerusalem, Barak agreed that we will divide the city. The east will be the capital of Palestine. West will be the capital of Israel. Hopefully that now it will be recognized. Because in this very moment that I speak with you, Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, is not recognized by any country. Even not our friends, the Americans, they don't recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, as you know. So this was the idea. We came to Camp David, and it was difficult to convince Arafat and Barak that this is the only way we can get out by dividing Jerusalem, having two cities, a kind of a roof municipality for both cities, open city, no borders, no walls, and the old city will be divided into its four quarters. You know, we have the Christian quarter, Armenian quarter, so three quarters will be Palestinian, one quarter, the Jewish quarter, will be Israel. So we agreed almost on everything. We were stuck with the question of Temple Mount. Temple Mount is a very small area in the middle of the old city. And to remind you, the old city is one, it's only 1% of Jerusalem. And the temple, Temple Mount, I don't know who of you have been there, is even less than that. It's less than 0.5% of Jerusalem. And this is the mountain that stands there. And we couldn't find a solution for that. And the argument was that, for Arafat at least, we need our sovereignty over our mosque. And without sovereignty, which means a flag, we are not going to have peace. This is issue number one for me, said Arafat. Now, Barak came to him and said, we agree to a flag, not to raise the Israeli flag there, okay? A green flag for Islam. Let's make it a holy place for Islam, okay? He said, no, Arafat, I want a Palestinian flag there. And I try to understand from him and also from Faisal, why is it so important, the Palestinian flag there? And then I understood, after I spoke with Arafat, that for him, it was the most important thing. His legacy depends on the flag, on the Haram. If he can bring back to the Muslim world the Temple Mount, the mosque, he will be in the history. And he had this kind of historical vision about himself and about his role here. It is not only peace with Israel, which is important. It's his role in the world Islamic he brought back to the Islamic world the Temple Mount. Third in importance for the Muslims after Mecca and Medina, you know. So it's only a Palestinian flag. And Barak said to me, Moshe, I can't go back to Israel with the Palestinian flag on Temple Mount. Temple Mount is the Jewish place. Our history is there. Abraham brought Isaac to sacrifice him on this Moria mountain. I said, come on, Mr. Prime Minister. This is history. These are stories. We're talking now about peace. Not only with the Palestinian, with the Arab world. That's what's in stake. So, let's find the solution. So he said, okay, Moshe, you are the expert. Bring me some ideas. So I brought him the ideas I had with Faisal Husseini. And both of them, the Prime Minister and the President of the Palestinians, they refused to take it. They had their own mind. We were just advisors. And in the end of the day, the summit failed because of Jerusalem. And it's not like what was told then in the newspapers. It was because the Palestinians were stubborn and Arafat was... That's not the truth. The truth of the matter is that both sides went to many... they accepted a lot of the things that they didn't think they will accept in the beginning of the summit. In the end of the day, they went quite a long way to each other. I can't say the way my Prime Minister said, he went out, he made a press conference and said, we couldn't come to an agreement because the stubbornness of Arafat. Bullshit, it's not wrong, it's not right. That's not what happened. Both sides went to each other and they couldn't find the formula to Temple Mount and to Jerusalem. And that's why the summit failed. And when the summit failed, started the second intifada, if you remember, half a year later, when Sharon, the new prime minister, because he lost the elections, Barak, the second intifada was called the Al-Aqsa Intifada. It was on the name of this mountain that we couldn't find a solution to. And since then, we are trying to find solutions for Temple Mount, for the Old City, for Jerusalem. And we cannot find them. We cannot find these solutions. And again, we come to the question of faith, of the believers, of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and God. So God is a player. He is there all the time. We speak about God and about his representatives. Who will represent God in this issue? Because when we have the borders or other issues in between us and the Palestinians, God is not involved. But when he is involved, we are deep, deep in a big trouble. I was in many conferences, you know, academic ones and political ones all over the world, but the most interesting one was when I, after Camp David, after we failed, I was invited by the king of Morocco, Hassan, the late Hassan, to give a lecture, which for me was the most exciting lecture I ever gave, in front of 56 heads of Muslim countries, presidents, prime ministers. They came to Morocco for a conference, and the name of the conference was Jerusalem, Al-Quds. So I, the Jew from Jerusalem, I'm invited to give a lecture. He wanted me to tell them a little bit about the future of Jerusalem, how I see it as an Israeli who was in the negotiations, and also tell them a little bit what happened with Al-Aqsa. Because everybody, you know, there were many rumors and many discussions about what happened, why Camp David failed. I wrote a book about it. You can read it in English in Amazon. It's called The Jerusalem Syndrome. By the way, when I say syndrome, I mean syndrome. There is a Jerusalem syndrome sickness, a very famous one. I don't know if you know. We have in Jerusalem every year about 200 cases of people, mainly Christians, but not only, some Jews, who are walking in the streets of Jerusalem, and they are going to meet Jesus Christ. They hope to see him in the corner of the street. If they don't see him, they speak to themselves. And after it, they are looking for King David, and he's not there anymore. And they are lunatic. So we put them in a hospital. We have a special hospital for these people, a mental hospital. And the sickness is called the Jerusalem syndrome, very famous. And we send them usually back home. And when I wrote my book, I used this term, this sickness, in which I said was the character of those who were dealing with Jerusalem in Camp David. I think my prime minister was sick with this sickness, because I spoke with him about these kind of things, and he said, Moshe, this is the place where King David was. This is the place where God gave us the Moriah mountain and Jerusalem and the country. And I said, Ehud, come on, you're a kibbutznik, you're an atheist. What are you becoming religious now? He said, no, but you know, I cannot come back to Israel giving up on Temple Mount. I said, big deal, what's Temple Mount? I mean, I conquered, I liberated Temple Mount. I'm telling you, I give it as a present to whoever wants it. Not a big deal. If we have peace. He said, no, I can't go back to Israel. And when I spoke with Arafat, it was the same reaction. He said, Haram al-Sharif, without Haram al-Sharif, I'm not delivering my historic mission to the Palestinian people. Because we Palestinians, he said it to me in a very honest way, we don't have anything. We don't have oil. We don't have money. We don't have friends in the world. We are the smallest Arab country. All we have is the Haram al-Sharif. You want to take it from us? No way. That's the only thing I have. So I have my flag there. And this is the legacy I will leave in history. So he also saw himself in the history liberating Jerusalem. Like me, like 40 others, conquerors of Jerusalem. They liberated Jerusalem. In the end of the day, of course, we couldn't have a solution. And I told all this to my audience there in Morocco. But I started my lecture by saying that, you know, I say to all these people, Jerusalem is a story. Jerusalem is a belief. Jerusalem is the place where God was and still is. But when you speak about Jerusalem, there are the differences between us, Muslims and Jews and Christians, is not so far. We are not so far from each other. But the story mothers are telling, Jewish mothers, Christian mothers, Muslim mothers, to their children, the songs they sing on Jerusalem come from the same place. It's the same song. It's the same story. It has nothing to do with facts. It has nothing to do with archaeology or what really happened there. The story is stronger than all the facts. You Muslims, I say to them, and they are sitting there, 55 leaders of the Muslim world, you know that Muhammad was not there. And I see immediately how they are getting white in their faces, looking at this Jew saying that Muhammad was not there. What do you mean he was not there? I mean, we Palestinians, we Muslims, we show his footsteps there on Temple Mount. When you go there, you will see, they will show you the place where Muhammad was standing. He said, he was not there. It's a story. We don't even have the name Jerusalem in the Quran, as you know. And they are getting more and more white in their face, looking at me, the Jew, who is telling them that Muhammad was not there. When their mother told them or sang the song when they were young about Muhammad going to Jerusalem. And they say, but forget it. It's not the facts we're dealing. It's the story, which is more important than the facts. But you can be relaxed. It's not only you Muslims. It's the Christians too. They go there in Jerusalem and they show exactly the place where he was crucified and buried. Bullshit. He was not buried there. He's not there. He was a Jew, by the way. And no Jew was buried in Jerusalem. He was buried outside. If he was, he was buried outside the city, definitely. But those who came to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, they stand there and cry on the grave, supposed grave of Jesus Christ. They are sure that he was in the Holy Sepulchre. But not only the Christians, the Jews, they go to the wailing wall and they cry, they touch the walls, the big stones, and cry and pray. This is the remain of the temple. Bullshit, it's not the remains of the temple. It's a wall that was built by Adrianus many years later to hold the mountain. It has nothing to do with the temple. The temple was destroyed. But try and tell these people who are standing them, this is not the temple. Stop crying here. Bullshit. Try. So after I said it, you know, they got a little bit relaxed, the Muslim leaders, thus, and they understood what the point. The point was not to say that it's ours, it's not yours, you have a story, we have the facts. No, we also have a story. And it's strong as well as your story, or the Christian story, for that matter. And the story matters. The story is more important than the facts. The story is more important than archaeologists will come and say, it's this way or the other way. And you know, the whole archaeology in Palestine, Israel today, is built on politics. Who was first here? We Jews are trying to convince the world that we were first here. And the Palestinians said, no, we were before you. We are the Canaanites. Intelligent people, professors I spoke with, said, Moshe, we were first here. We are the Canaanites. I said, what do you mean you are the Canaanites? You have any proof? No, that's the story. We are the Canaanites. And after the Canaanites, you conquered. The children of Israel conquered the place. What does it matter who was first here? It matters. For these people, it matters. So all I'm trying to say is that in the Islamic world, Christian world, Jewish, Israeli world, the story is more important than the facts. And the belief that God gave us Jerusalem, us, the Muslims, or us, the Christians for that matter, or us Israelis, this is not a story. It's a kind of a fact that now we will fight in order to keep Jerusalem united. Now, years come. Went on, and more and more Israelis, as more and more Palestinians understand now that they will not be able to have a solitude or just their autonomy or just their city, Jerusalem. It will have to be shared. I mean, this idea that I came with Faisal Husseini 25 years ago, now most Palestinians share and most Israelis share. We have the polls and we know. And most Israelis are ready to divide Jerusalem. This was not the case 20 years ago when I started to speak about dividing Jerusalem. I think 5 to 6% of the Israelis were ready to speak about the idea of dividing Jerusalem. Today, the majority of Israelis understand that in the end of the day, this is the solution for the city. It's also most of the Palestinians understand that this is the solution for their city. So we remain with the question of how do we get from here to this kind of arrangement. The Israeli-Palestinian struggle is not over yet. Many people are very pessimistic about the prospects of peace in the Middle East. I'm one of the few, I was always one of the few, who believe that we can reach and we will reach peace between us and the Palestinians. And the main question of Jerusalem will be solved. It will be solved the way many things were solved in Europe. People were fighting in Europe for 500 years. The French and the Germans, they killed millions. And in the end of the day, they have a kind of a confederation with one coin and one market, and they are allies. So if you ask me, what's your vision, Moshe Amirav, for the future? I don't know when, but it will definitely be like that. We will have a confederation, might be Jordan, Palestine as a free country, and Israel. We will have Jerusalem as the city of peace, Ir Shalom in Hebrew, the way it was called in the Bible. We will have a kind of a confederation in which the borders will not be so important as in Europe. So why divide Jerusalem? Why do we need a wall, another wall, or another border in the city? I believe it should be, and can be, an open city. Open city not only in the sense of movement. Open because it's open in the mind of people. This is a city that raises so many emotions all over the world. I always tell my students that when I go to places, remote places, where like Indonesia, I say, 200 million people, they know, they don't know where is Israel. But when I say Jerusalem, they know. I met with the foreign minister of Egypt a few years ago, and he said, you know, Moshe, I look at the television and I see what your soldiers are doing there on Temple Mount to the Muslims who are coming to pray, and I'm in a shock. How do you do it? And, you know, I start to tell them the story of security and this and that. He said, look, I'm not defending the Palestinians. The hell with the Palestinians. You can kill them. I don't care about them. But you put your police and your soldiers in my mountain, on my mosque. I said, your mosque? Yes, it's his mosque. He looks at television in Cairo and he sees the Israeli soldiers there and those who are coming to pray. And he sees the riots and he cries. I'm telling you that. I'm telling it to Israelis, because Israelis think that they have the monopoly. They are the only ones who cry because of Jerusalem. All the rest doesn't care. Of course people care. Christians and Muslims all over the world. So we have to make this city such that people will see in it back, city of peace, Ir Shalom. As I told you, it's not a lecture. It's not academic one, definitely. It's a story that I'm telling you, my story, the way I see Jerusalem, the way I dream Jerusalem will be in the future. I live in Jerusalem. It's my city, but it's also your city. It's also the Muslims' city. It's a city of the world. Whoever is a believer has to feel toward Jerusalem the way I feel. Not to say Israeli. I'm a believer. I'm not religious. I'm Jewish. But I'm a believer. I believe that there is something behind our secularity. There is something that we meant to be. And I'm trying to do it in my own way, with my children, in Jerusalem. So if we are speaking about the future, I believe that Jerusalem will be the city of peace. It will be a model for many countries. I'm sure about it. I don't know when it will happen. I don't know if I will see it in my lifetime. But this is my vision, and I know many Palestinians who are in my vision. I know Muslims who are in my visions, and I know Israelis who are in my vision. Not all the Israelis are in this category that Palestinians are, that this is my city, our city. It's not like that. It's getting better through the years, and I can see in the last 30 years how the opinion shift among Palestinians, among Israelis. We are much more ready now for a solution. Even the current government, which looks like a right-wing government, Prime Minister Netanyahu, he is, and I'm telling you a secret, okay, don't tell anyone, he is ready to divide Jerusalem. Okay? He understands what I am writing for years in the papers, that if we don't divide Jerusalem, we lose Jerusalem. And I'll end by the facts, because it's important. In Jerusalem, the situation is that the majority of the people are not Zionist in Zion. We have the ultra-religious, about a third of the population, they are not Zionist. In the day of independence, when the whole country, Israel, stands still, and I stand for my friends who fell in the wars, and there is the siren going on, all over Israel, you come to Jerusalem, you see all these people, the Jews in Mea Shearim, in all these religious, they walk, they go like this, they don't stand. They are not Zionists. They're Jewish, not Zionists. Of course, when you come to the other side, the Arabic side, Palestinian side, nobody stands there still. They don't care about it. So I'm in a minority in Zion. I'm a Zionist. I'm a minority in Zion. And this minority, it's a shrinking minority. in average, the Palestinians have between 5 to 6 children. The ultra-religious has between 6 to 8 children. I have 3 children. So you see the statistics and you understand that in 10, 20 years, I will be, the Zionists in Jerusalem will be a tiny minority. I'm going to lose the city. So before I lose the city, I'm trying to find a solution. I'll stop here. I would like to hear your opinion about it. If you have questions, I'll be glad to answer. It can be on the personal level, political level. I'm not coming from as a religious man, so I can't answer all the religious questions. But the political one, I'm the expert. Please
tell me. What was the solution you
want? We came, Faisal Husseini and me, with the idea. Faisal was trying to convince Arafat, I was trying to convince Barak. The idea was that we had to speak about the mountain, just the mountain, that the sovereignty will not be Palestinian. It will not be Israeli. It will be sovereignty for God. So Barak, when I came, said, what do you mean, Moshe Amiravu? What do you mean by sovereignty of God? Who will run the place? I mean, there is somebody has to take tickets from the tourists. Somebody has to put water. And God, who, I said, why do we have to do it? Those who are in the clergy of the Muslims, the Palestinians, the Israeli rabbis, and if you want to take some Christians in, I don't care, let them have a committee and they will deal with the water, electricity, and tourists. Why do we have to deal with it? It's anyway, it's nothing there. It's just tourists there, actually. And prayer, so, you know, people are coming to pray, Muslims, basically. So it's not such a big deal to handle it. So we don't need a big, it's not a big deal. And as I said, Faisal couldn't convince Arafat to go on this solution. And Barak said to me very clearly, Moshe, I can't go back home with such a solution without the Israeli flag there. And then Clinton came with the idea of this upper level for the Palestinian sovereignty and lower level Israeli sovereignty. But this was also being rejected by Arafat. He said, no, I know the Jews. They are going, you're going to give them sovereignty down, you know, the Kotel, the wall, Wailing Wall. I know them. They will start digging inside and then upside. They will go up. They will destroy the temple and build their temple. They want to build the temple. For years they are saying they are going to build the temple. So, Mr. President, he said to Clinton, I know these Jews. I'm not ready for that. It's either my sovereignty or there is no peace. So this was the block in Camp David. Any other questions, please? Yes, please. Can you present yourself?
My name is Rajan. My name is
Prabhat. Whatever has to do with Temple Mounts is political, nothing to do with God or Allah for that matter. It's political. In the 30s already of the 20th century, the leader of the Palestinians then in the 30s, Husseini, not this Husseini, from the same family, another Husseini, said, we can beat the Jews, then we didn't have Israel yet, we can beat the Jews by having the Islamic world with us. They, the Jews, they have the money, they have America. We have the Arab world, the Muslim world. How can we reach the Muslim world? By saying the Jews want to take Haram al-Sharif. If we put this fear in the hearts of Muslims all over the world, we have comrades. We can stop the Zionists from building their state. So Jerusalem will be our flag against Zionism. Zionism is Zion. So the Jews are coming to Zion. We will show them that Al-Aqsa is more important and the Islamic power of all these Muslims in the world, we will stop them. So he used Temple Mount. And whenever there were riots in the 30s, when the British were in rule, he was happy. Because it was then we didn't have television. But then the whole Islamic world knew that the Jews are going to take our mosque. And they got the solidarity of the Arab Muslim world. And it goes like that until this very day. The Palestinians understand that the battle cry is Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif. If they say Haram al-Sharif, the whole Muslim world is with them against the Jews. And that's the situation right now. It has nothing to do with God, not religion. There's nothing to read. It's a political issue became.
But he was wondering about Sharon visiting the Temple Mount.
This was an act
kicked off the Intifada.
Sharon has nothing to do with religion. I know Sharon. he was eating pork every morning. He has nothing to do with Judaism. He said so. I'm not religious at all. I don't care about it. There is God. It was a political act. And it came after it was known after Camp David that Barak was ready to give up Temple Mount. So it was a demonstration, a political demonstration. We, the right wing, we will not let it. So he went up there and he started the riots. And the riots were not because of Sharon. The riots were because we Palestinians, we couldn't reach peace. So now we have to show the Israelis, if they don't want peace, we will show them. We will have another intifada. You know, this was the second intifada. And this was all, I mean, Sharon's growing up, there was an excuse to start the second intifada. So we are not talking really about religious things. We are talking about political issues. And we use Temple Mount, we Israelis and we Palestinians, to fight each other. That's a very good excuse. Yes, please. Can you present yourself?
Yeah, my name is Richard Brunella. I was actually a Canadian diplomat at our office in Ramallah.
No.
Not complicated. But, yeah. What is your, that's a very long...
Okay, no, I will answer you. I think that when it comes to the practical issues, it's much more simple than you think. I'm talking about symbols. You understand? Symbols are very important. So with symbols, it's difficult to find the kind of coexistence or sharing or whatever. But when we come to the practical day by day, it's not such a problem. It's not such a problem. First of all, if you look at Jerusalem, we have a very clear East Palestinian, West Israeli. 99%. 1% is what we call settlers. Okay, we have Jewish settlers who went to the eastern side, to the Arab side, and they took a house among the Arab neighborhood, and they are the only three families surrounded with Palestinians. But they are... That's a political act, you understand? It's not that they like to live there. It's terrible to live there. They have two policemen on the roof and three soldiers near the house, day and night. So what's the fun? How can they live? That's a political act of groups. Now we have militant Jewish groups and we have militant Palestinian groups there. But all in all, when we come to an arrangement, it's very easy in Jerusalem. And I said it in the very beginning. We have a problem with a very tiny place, less than 1% of the city in terms of territory, that is in a debate. That is, we can't agree on it. All the rest, 99%, it's very clear. Everybody knows. The Palestinians who live in Jerusalem, the Israelis, the world, the diplomats, everybody knows exactly how this city will be divided. It's very easy. In order to do it, we need the political will, and we need political leaders who are not afraid. But this comes to another lecture I give in the university about leadership. Who is a leader? Is a political leader the one who goes and tries to satisfy the majority in order to be elected, re-elected? Is this a leader? Menachem Begin went to have peace with Egypt, and most of his party were against him. He got the majority in the Knesset, in the parliament, for the peace against his own people in the Likud, in the Herut movement then. He was brave. Rabin went to peace with Jordan against a lot of people in his party who were against it. So we are talking about leadership, a courageous one, of people who are ready to go beyond the lines, beyond the convention, and stand up against their own party, own friends, and say, this is what we do. Sharon was like that. He said, Sharon was the father of the settlements in Israel. He is the organizer, the ideological, and he evacuated thousands of Jews from Gaza. And everybody was in a shock. I mean, he is the greatest settler. He is the fighter against the police. He is taking us out with the army and the police. You remember it, not so many years ago. He was a brave man. He changed his mind. Begin changed his mind. Many people changed their mind. I changed my mind. I was in the Likud party, in the right. Now I'm in the left. It's no big deal. What's the big deal? If you come to reality and you see it doesn't work this way, you have to find another way. The fact that I'm ready to divide Jerusalem doesn't mean that I'm not a Zionist. Or that I give up on Jerusalem. I will never give up on Jerusalem. It's my city. It's my capital. But we can be with a little bit of open-minded, with a little bit of vision. And also, especially, we need it towards the Palestinians. They are the weak ones. We are the strong ones. So we have to be large, as we say in the translation from Hebrew. We have to be open and say, okay, we are ready to share with you. And if we will have leaders like that, we will reach peace. Ehud Barak was very close. I trusted him. He asked me to walk with him. I said, yes, I think he will bring us peace. He is the most decorated general, a very brave man. In the end, he got to be afraid. He said, what are you afraid of? You are going to bring peace with the Palestinians after 100 years of struggle. He was afraid, this brave man. So what we need is not so much sophistication. We don't need all this kind of... We need to see reality and be enough, open your heart to the other side, the Palestinians, who are weak. They have nothing to lose. If we understand it, the leaders of my country, will understand it, we will have peace. We are very close to peace. I tell my friends that, they call me here and there from the New York Times, other newspapers to interview me. And I ask them, I say to this guy from the New York Times, why you call me? Because it's difficult for you to find the optimist among the Israelis. So I'm the last optimist, right? He said, yes, you're right, Professor Amiram. So I'm the last optimist in Israel. Okay, here you see. Any other questions or comments?
I'd like to just return to the singular issue here of the Temple Mount. And just to check my understanding of what you have had to say here and in your book. So you're suggesting that the Temple Mount needs to be given over to the actor, God.
Yes. He is the only one.
He's the only one. In other words, all the rest of these issues are political in a fundamental way and about political negotiation.
And can be solved. This is a problem.
Right. But the Temple Mount is a place where you have narrative layered on narrative, layered on narrative, story on story on story. And so when you make your case, when you made your case to Barak, when your friend Faisal Husseini made his case to Arafat, part of the problem is that these political leaders were not religious. They could not understand the meaning of those narratives. They collapsed the meaning of those narratives and the symbolic power they have into their political register. So do I understand that correctly? And are you suggesting then that the way to solve the Temple Mount issue is simply to have a committee that represents the three Muslims, Jews, Christians perhaps, to make the practical decisions, to have them work in a unanimous way, and in that sense convince them or invite them to call on their own better angels, which is this place is a holy place. It is only God that's the actor here. So, the political stuff can just bugger off.
That's exactly what I say to my prime minister.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going into the details. I just told him, look.
You use that Latin phrase, too, bugger off. Didn't you?
Yeah. Come on. Let's go away. We, politicians, Israelis, Palestinians, let's take the whole issue of Temple Mount and have a committee of Muslim leaders, Jewish leaders. Let them sit with the Pope in Rome. He will host them for a week, and they will find a solution. Whatever they agree, I agree.
And they'll get to eat Italian food, which will make it much easier.
Great.
Well, any last comments or queries? Rockin?
When we deal with Jerusalem, the facts are not important. The stories are important. Because the stories is the narrative. And the narrative, I'll give you another example, okay? So you will understand. We have the Holocaust, we Israelis, Jews. I mean, that's the narrative that dictates whatever. I mean, even our relationship to the agreement with Iran right now, as you know. I mean, we come back immediately to Auschwitz. It's a complex. I mean, so this is the narrative. The narrative is that if Iran has the bomb, we are doomed to Auschwitz. I don't think so, but this is the narrative. Okay? So we had the narrative of the Holocaust. But we are now in a conflict with people who also have a narrative. And you know the narrative of the Palestinians. It's the Nakba in Arabic. Have you heard about the word Nakba? The Nakba is the disaster. 48 disaster. It was a disaster. It was not a Holocaust, no concentration camps, no gas chambers. It was a catastrophe. What was the catastrophe? To put it in one sentence. More than half of the Palestinians left Palestine waiting to come back after the victory. They didn't come back. Most of them left with the help of Israeli soldiers and army. They were put on trucks, brought to the Jordan River and said goodbye. They were brought to Gaza. You know that most of the people in Gaza are refugees from Jaffa. It was a catastrophe for the Palestinian people. When they started the war against Israel, against the Zionists in 48, they were sure they will win. Why were they sure they will win? Because all the Arab countries said, we are coming to help you. In the end, bullshit, and nobody really came. They sent, you know, symbolic groups, troops to fight. But in the end of the day, they lost the war. And half of the Palestinian nation disappeared. And the Palestinians who stayed in Israel lost their identity. They became Israeli Arabs. They're even in the parliament. The others, the Palestinians in Jordan, became Jordanians. They don't call themselves Palestinians anymore. This was a disaster. It was not a Holocaust, of course, but they see it as a Holocaust. So, who am I to tell them how to feel? Am I going to tell them, look, my suffering was much bigger in Auschwitz than you in Jaffa? Bullshit. You can't convince somebody that his suffering is not as mine. You cannot do it. So I take it as it is. They had their Holocaust. And when I say it, Israelis are very angry with me. I mean, how can you compare? I'm not comparing. I'm just saying. If they feel like that, that's what they feel. I can say 10 times to the Palestinians, don't feel like that. You were not in Auschwitz. Bullshit. I mean, how can I say it to a Palestinian who feels like that? So the feeling is important. The narrative is important. The story is important more than the facts. When we come to Jerusalem, it's very strong. In Jerusalem, where God attends, my God, yes, Allah. It's not your God, it's my God. He gave it to me. I have the book, I have the certificate that he gave it to me. So how can I deal with it? I mean, that's how people believe. And the belief and the story, I started by the story that you got when you were 2 years old in a song from your mother, Jewish or Muslim for that matter. you can't take it away. So recognize it. Not only recognize it, I say to Barak, you have to appreciate it, you have to honor it, that's his story. You can say it's not the facts. I don't care about the facts.
But you can also use it, in the best sense of that word, to actually transform the conditions.
Yes.
As you suggested, by this is letting what the actor on the Temple Mount be the only actor.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing all my life. I'm trying to take the narratives, put them into another box, and sell it to the Palestinians and to the Israelis. But the Prime Minister of Israel doesn't want to buy my merchandise. What can I say?
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So you are all now invited to Jerusalem. I hope I triggered you a little bit to see the city. Please do come. I've come to your place. It's beautiful here. You'll see the beautiful...